Welcome to another edition of Deloitte Global Insights, a production of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu. My name is Siobhan Harris, and I will be your moderator today. Deloitte Global Insights is an audio news podcast that looks at important cross-border issues that affect the global business community. Today's program, The Future of the Life Sciences Industries, Transformation Amid Rising Risk. Today we'll be talking about the need for life sciences companies to transform themselves to survive, given today's volatile economic outlook. What internal and external forces have brought the life sciences industries to their current uncertain state? What approaches will companies take as they transform to meet today's new market realities? For nearly a decade, life sciences companies have struggled against low productivity in research and development, expiry of patents, price competition from generic producers, a rising cost base, an ongoing talent shortage and diminishing corporate reputations. In response to these and other challenges, many life sciences organizations recognize that they need to change their business model, both to avoid becoming lower margin suppliers and to survive in the long term. How executives plan to do this is the focus of a new report from the Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu Global Life Sciences and Healthcare Industry Group, which draws on a recent survey of 360 senior life sciences industry executives by Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu and the Economist Intelligence Unit, as well as interviews with business leaders, regulators, and academics. The report, The Future of the Life Sciences Industries, Transformation Amid Rising Risk, identifies a significant shift in the way that life sciences companies are moving forward. Specifically, they're seeing the need to transform from a high-risk, high-margin business model to one with managed risks and potentially variable margins. This new business model is, in some views, a more intelligent approach to addressing future risk. The resultant shift will likely involve transformation throughout an entire company, from its sales and market approaches to its cultivation of talent to its relationship with regulators and other industry stakeholders. Here today to discuss these issues are John Rhodes and Stuart Henderson. John is Global Life Sciences Sector Leader for Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu. Stuart is the Europe, Middle East, and Africa Regional Life Sciences and Healthcare Leader for Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu. Welcome to Deloitte Global Insights, gentlemen.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
And I'm delighted to be here also.
Now, life sciences companies today appear to be experiencing unprecedented challenges to their long-term viability. What forces would you say are creating the need for companies to transform their business models and operations? Do you think we're in the middle of a true crisis?
Well, it might be a bit strong to suggest we're in the middle of a true crisis for the life sciences industry overall, but clearly we're in the middle of a period of time where there is significant transformation occurring for the companies, and it's really occurring on many, many fronts. We're seeing the companies struggle with the innovation and development of new products at a time when there's also very significant pressures from both consumers and governments to establish a fair price for the products that are coming to market.
The survey results indicate that it's the larger life sciences companies that seem the most convinced that wholesale changes are going to be required in order to meet future risks. Stuart, why do you think this is the case?
They've got the most to lose. The largest companies have got the greatest issue with the patent expiries, the largest R&D spend, the largest amount of sales and marketing infrastructure spend, and therefore the transformation of the political landscape and the pricing regulatory landscape has the greatest impact on those companies.
Yeah, I'd agree with Stuart. It's really interesting for the largest companies because they are truly the most at risk in terms of, you know, either the traditional business model for the industry or the most recently emerged business model. And it's really moved the larger companies into what almost seems to be a desperate search for new significant products and innovative medicines for patients. At the same time, you see fascinating pace of consolidation in an industry which has been fragmented for a long period of time, and the largest 10 companies in particular have restructured significantly in terms of trimming jobs and focusing their efforts in more critical areas. But I think it'd be a bit premature to think the large companies have come to an end. But particularly, this is a very resilient industry. By its very nature, it reinvents itself.
Now, John, earlier you mentioned the need for new products and a new approach mm-hmm. to tackling problems. And it seems that in order to survive in the long term, a lot of life sciences companies are realizing that they have to tackle current things and really address things in new, more intelligent ways. One of the biggest barriers to effective strategic risk management is identifying and assessing emerging risks. Why do you think this is so difficult?
Well, for the life sciences industry, you have such a long-term product innovation and development life cycle. So your investment is typically made in, you know, years in advance and over long periods of time before you might have a success. And I think the companies in the past probably were less nimble than you'll see in the future, or where they need to be in the future. And part of this is managing your risk in a new, more intelligent and nimble way, so that you either invest in more opportunities and maybe in more of a limited fashion, but also you're terminating investments more quickly if you don't see a particular payoff or pathway to future success.
It's the rate of change, covering technology change, regulatory change, and political change against that backdrop that John has set out of the long life cycle, product development cycles within pharmaceutical companies. You know, that the balance of those two things and working out an effective strategic risk management program at any point in time when you have those long cycles but you have a changing landscape hitting you on almost on a daily basis, it's very difficult to get that balance right between tactics and strategy in identifying and dealing with the risks that you're facing.
So you would say it's difficult to adhere to the, you know, the need to address current problems when you don't really know what the current problem will be when your product is ready for market.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you overlay on that the broader macroeconomic situation at the moment and the disruptive quality that is bringing to this rate of change. It's nobody's, I think, pretending that this is an easy issue, otherwise we'd all be finding the answer and getting on with our lives.
360 executives participating in the Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu EIU Global Survey identified four areas where they believe risk will rise most sharply within the next 10 years. These areas are pricing, sales and marketing, regulatory affairs, talent management, and research and development. In your opinion, what are some of the specific risks associated with each of these areas, and what strategies could companies employ to address them? Let's start with pricing, sales, and marketing.
Certainly the cost to find and deliver products has increased, while at the same time there's natural pressures on government payers and other payers of medical costs to bring some of the increases in balance with the outcomes that patients are experiencing. So you've got real pressure on the ability to raise prices, particularly if new drugs look very similar to drugs that are on the market already. So you have governments, particularly in 2009, under extreme budgetary pressure. And if a company is bringing a product to market that offers very little in the way of new medical outcome, it's going to be difficult to command a price premium. And that seems fair to companies, and they understand that. And in fact, companies, for those reasons, are starting to differentiate the medicines they're seeking to discover in particularly innovative areas. At the same time, these companies are diversifying their risk profile by, you know, having large patented branded pharmaceutical companies invest in generics for the first time. So you see the industry shifting to play both in the new innovative medicine areas that will probably command the best pricing in global markets, and at the same time having more products to offer at prices that will be delivered, you know, in all economies in the world to all potential patients. So quite an evolution on the pricing front.
Now, despite the fact that life sciences is one of the most regulated industries, the executives responding to the Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu EIU survey said that they expect risk to rise sharply in the regulatory area. What would you say are some potential strategies to mitigate the regulatory risk?
Well, I think it comes back, again, primarily to working with the regulators and the payers. It's helping the regulator fully understand the complexity around particularly new technologies and techniques and approaches, working with them to find the optimum way to design trials that actually mean products going into certainly the later stages of clinical development have the best chance of getting to being a marketed product. And you know, there are a lot of strategies and techniques there involving more selective enrollment in clinical trials, using the new technology such as biomarkers to identify populations. But all this really needs to be taking the regulator at the same scientific pace, if you like, through the understanding of the new technology.
Now let's turn our attention to the two remaining risk areas, talent management and research and development. Talent management was identified by more than 70% of survey respondents as an area where risk would rise, particularly in terms of skill shortages and talent retention. Now, as the life sciences industry transforms themselves for the future, what types of workforce skills will be needed? And what strategies do you think companies can use to attract and retain high-value employees?
I think of two things in this area. In particular, in terms of the shortage, I think there's the concern that you won't have the right scientific talent, particularly to discover some of the innovations that are likely to come in the area of biologics. So biologics, which is proven to be you know, some of the pathway to the most significant discoveries of some of the most difficult to treat diseases out of biotech products. I think the skill set in terms of what's available in the industry, what's coming out of institutions is lacking. And certainly there's a gap there in terms of the skill sets needed and certainly some's being developed in the field in this relatively new segment of the industry. However, it's not on a scale that is necessary to support, you know, the number of products that could be developed in the future. So you have a clear skill shortage currently and anticipated in the R&D side. I think you take that as well as the transformation that's needed in the industry overall, you see a lot more keener interest from companies in bringing in outsiders to the industry than you did in the past. So it was not unusual to find the same individuals moving from company to company in a pretty kind of closed circuited talent pool that worked in the life sciences industry. And I think recently trying to learn from other industries' experiences that have gone through transformation, there's been a lot more hiring of individuals that have the skill sets that worked in other industries, but particularly in areas that may be more cost sensitive. So there's a keener interest on finance executives or purchasing executives that have lived and survived, if you will, in industries with much lower margins than what's typically been you know, available to life science companies.
Again, I would endorse everything John said, and just anecdotally, you know, from talking to my client base and listening to discussions around the conference circuit, it's quite clear to me that there is a disconnect existing today between what pharmaceutical companies require of people leaving academia and what academia is producing. I think there are two things that can be done there. One is more effective engagement, and secondly, pharmaceutical companies taking more of a lead in developing the training programs to take the raw talent that's coming out of schools, university, and research institutes, and tailoring them more to those key skills that are required in their environment. And the second part of the question, the strategies that companies use to attract and retain, I think in today's environment, it is all about the working environment, and I think the survey results point to that. You need to have a good place to work, and you need short-term remunerative reward. It's quite clear that the reward strategies that perhaps worked in the past, stock options, etc., have been somewhat devalued over the last 5 or 6 years, and this generation of young aspiring science graduates wants to be shown the money here and now.
And now it's been said that research and development is the root of the life sciences industry, and it seems that it's at the root of the industry's need for transformational change. And as high-risk, high-reward opportunities become less attractive to companies, life sciences firms are going to need to explore less risky R&D strategies. But which ones? And how can companies better manage their R&D portfolio to mitigate or share the risk?
In terms of exploring less risky R&D strategies, just speak to that a minute in terms of how to view that. So by nature, it's always going to be risky, but I think the companies realize that you cannot have all your bets in the most risky part of the industry. So what's been particularly fascinating is you certainly have companies that are focused on primarily biotech. You have companies focused in other areas, but you see much more tendency emerging for companies to play, again, in a variety of directions. So you may have some working on what's perceived to be the most risky biologic drugs that are curing, hopefully, MS, potentially Alzheimer's in the future in areas where there's tremendous unmet medical need right now. But at the same time, those companies are investing in generic businesses, in what I'll call a specialty model, where companies are learning to be happy not controlling the R&D process from discovery to sale. So you're playing in different pieces of the discovery cycle in different ways. So sometimes that's through a partnership, sometimes it's through alliance, sometimes you'll manufacture the drug, sometimes you may not. So it's diversification of risk and you know, managing your overall portfolio risk.
What else do you think life sciences executives can learn about managing risk from external stakeholders and other industries?
But let's look at industries that have faced, I guess, the challenge of commoditization over time. The chemical industry, semiconductor industry, industries such as those that have faced this enormous commoditization and price pressure, and they've survived through just a complete obsession with a customer, embracing technology to understand the customer, reaching out to the customer to find out what it is ultimately they want, and delivering a technology response that pushes the boundaries on further and leaves the commodities to the followers in their industry. So if there's one thing that I think, again, it's been a recurring theme, it's understanding who your customer is and working with them to drive the next generation of medical innovation with that customer base.
I think the industry is trying to learn from, you know, what other industries have done well, particularly ones that have had to diversify their portfolios. So I think if you look at some prior lessons in maybe the energy sector or more broadly the chemical sector, you've seen evolution where there's been threats to the margins, either because of, you know, global competitive challenges or slow period, if you will, in new innovation where products were copied and sold at cheaper prices. I think the industry is trying to learn from those examples, but it will be very challenging to make a wholesale adoption of what might have worked in some other industries, but taking bits and pieces, if you will, and learning from those to try to improve upon what pharma might be able to do in a similar fashion well. So just perhaps that as a footnote to what Stuart was saying.
And if you were to summarize the most important steps that life sciences companies should take to transform from a high-risk, high-margin business model to one with more managed risks and potentially variable margins. What do you think those steps would be?
It's really a transformational strategy to balance returns and risk. So some of that will be achieved through the collaborations and alliances you might try to pursue to allow you to participate in more potential new product opportunities or ones to mitigate risk. And these have come in many shapes and sizes. I'll just give you one example. So in many cases, these large pharmaceutical companies have more potential molecules and chemical entities in their labs than they're able to fund. And it's usually a choice of which ones are the most likely to provide the greatest medical benefit and also bring the largest rewards to the shareholder. So at any point in time, if you think of a warehouse of these potential discoveries, they have to make selections and they have to make prioritization. So usually you try to put them in three buckets, high, medium, and low, something very logical. And clearly each year they'll fund the high ones. And the medium ones, they'll look for opportunities for other companies to potentially help fund those and bring them to market. Sometimes it's a matter of funding alone. Sometimes it's a matter of pairing up with another company that has a greater expertise. And sometimes it's just a matter of, this looks like a good product, but it won't yield the most significant result either for patients or for the shareholders. An example of that might be a product that comes online in a field where there's already three or four medicines by the time it launches. Clearly, that's going to be under pressure for reimbursement and pricing controls, but at the same time, it's not necessarily offering anything unique to a broad class of patients, but it may offer something in a way of distinguishing treatment for some patients. So I'll give you an example. There may be 50 products in research now for the next round of treatment for diabetes. Only three or four of those 50 will probably come to market either because of the science involved or the timing or be positioned in the market to yield a satisfactory return. So a company might perceive that as other than a high priority and balance the risk by getting another company to participate in that activity. So I think in years gone by, companies would have looked at that like every other opportunity and poured money after it and tried to control the outcome solely on its own efforts. Clearly today you'll see a lot more diversification of risk by sharing those kinds of opportunities is just one example.
I think my closing thoughts are really that the first stage on this journey is recognizing that the transformation that we've been talking about today is not an issue of competitive advantage, that perhaps three or four years ago somebody who broke away from the pack and espoused a new business model, a new set of transforming activities and how they organized their R&D were maybe an early adopter of a model that collaborated with early stage biologics companies. That's not an issue of competitive advantage anymore. That's an issue of being one of the companies that's going to succeed going forward. And the corollary is, if you're not a transformer, then it is unlikely that you're going to survive profitably into the future. So I think the first part of that journey is just recognition that transformation is no longer a nice to have. And then the second point, again, I think, which has been a recurring theme throughout the survey and our discussion today, is this whole issue of making the regulators, the payers, the reimbursers, and the patient groups party to that journey. And as part of that transformation, make all those groups far more embedded in the forward-looking strategy of every future successful pharmaceutical company.
Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us today on Deloitte Global Insights. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
And it's been a pleasure for me also.
Thank you.
Visit Deloitte.com/life sciences to download the report, The Future of the Life Sciences Industries, Transformation Amid Rising Risk, and to access articles, newsletters, and other information of interest. You've been listening to the Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu production of Deloitte Global Insights, the program that looks at today's important cross-border issues that affect the global business community. We want to hear from you. Contact us with your feedback or suggestions for future podcast topics, and find Deloitte Global Insights at deloitte.com/globalinsights. This has been a production of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu. Thanks for listening, and goodbye for now. Deloitte refers to one or more of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu, a Swiss Verein, and its network of member firms, each of which is a legally separate and independent entity. Please see www.deloitte.com/about for a detailed description of the legal structure of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu and its member firms.